Welcome to the Binder Family Speaker Series, a podcast dedicated to high-level research on contemporary anti-Semitism by fostering productive and collegial discussion of the most pertinent issues before us. Hosted by the Indiana University Institute for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism. For more information about this speaker series, ISCA news, or videos of past webinars, please visit our website at isca.indiana.edu. And now to present our speaker, Dr. Alvin H. Rosenfeld.
Special thanks, Michal, to you. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Yesterday was a terrifying day for Israel, but thanks to the IDF, also Bezrat Hashem, Israel came through it, and here you are with us. Everything you're going to say is absolutely pertinent to the concerns of all of us on the webinar. For those of you who have not yet heard Michal Kotlovunch speak, you're in for a treat. She's a very, very well-informed and passionate speaker. She engages with just those matters that really matter a whole lot. Briefly, she was born in Jerusalem. She studied at the Hebrew University and took a degree in law from that university. She lives for different times also in Canada, where she both studied and taught at McGill University. On top of all of that, like just about every other Israeli, she served in the IDF. She's also served in the Knesset. And right now, she's Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, which means there are not enough hours in the day or night for her to do all the work that she has. So it's really great of you, Michal, to take time out from a very, very busy life and very busy schedule to join us. I now hand over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Alvin and Gunther and everybody who's here. I appreciate your taking the time on a Sunday to engage in what I believe is possibly the most important conversation of our time, not just because of Israel and not just because of the anti-Semitism that has been a tsunami that is overwhelming, but actually what I believe is an existential challenge to the foundations of our democracies, indeed to humanity. So what I would propose is just maybe to outline or frame the conversation that we can have, and then hopefully we can have a chance for a bit of a discussion in the time that will remain. As Alvin said, as Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, and I should mention not only that I was appointed just about 3 weeks before 10/7, but that there are anti-Semitism special envoys from around the world mandated to identifying and combating anti-Semitism for the last few years. So this rise in anti-Semitism did not begin on 10/7. There has been a constant rise, actually creating the need for countries, Canada, the United States, many European countries, South American countries, to appoint special envoys for combating anti-Semitism. Israel joined a little bit later in the game. I'm Israel's second special envoy for combating anti-Semitism. And as I said, having been appointed about 3 weeks before the war, all of my plans for the creation of a national strategy, which we need desperately, and I would say an international strategy, as Israel is also the nation state of the Jewish people, of course, has been overtaken by this sense of emergency, of this raging rise in anti-Semitism. 10/7, and I'll say I call it 10/7 intentionally, it isn't random, because like 9/11, the massacre, the war crimes, the crimes against humanity perpetrated by thousands of barbaric savages, there's no other word for what happened on 10/7 that must be unequivocally condemned. The fact that 10/7 actually, like 9/11, should have changed the world and did not change the world is something that we have to pause on. Because the very same anti-Semitism that fueled the atrocities, the war crimes, the crimes against humanity, burning and rape and massacre and murder and abduction of 10/7, the very same anti-Semitism fueled the responses to those war crimes and those crimes against humanity that were silent, Me Too unless you're a Jew, that denied, even as those 3,000 plus barbaric savages live streamed the atrocities of 10/7 and denial began to set in, that justify Rape is resistance, if you will, including Judith Butler, who I remember studying in law school, explaining that not only is this not an act of terror, and not only is it not an act of anti-Semitism, but it is in fact armed resistance, if you will. That not only all of that were silent, denied, justified, and supported Hamas on campuses, on streets, and on social media, but in fact, that attacked Jews in the wake of the worst atrocities perpetrated against Jews since the Holocaust. And so I think that we really meet at an existential moment of reckoning for all of the places and spaces in which this process of the demonization and the delegitimization and the double standards against the state of Israel, the proverbial Jew among the nations, has taken hold. And I'll begin my own analysis actually in the understanding of not only the failed conventional wars from 1948, the moment in which, according to Israel's Declaration of Independence, the vision, mission, values of the State of Israel, as the nation state of the Jewish people, a prototypical indigenous people that speaks the same language and traverses the same land and reads the same book and practices the same customs and rituals for thousands of years. That prototypical indigenous people returned to an ancestral homeland after thousands of years of exile and persecution and is committed to equality. That is Israel's Declaration of Independence. A series of conventional wars from 1948 to 1973 actually failed in their stated mission to annihilate that nation state to which Jews and indigenous people returned after millennia of exile and persecution. And in 1975, if I would begin my analysis to understand that 10/7 did not happen, if you will, in a vacuum, as the Secretary General of the UN reminded us. In fact, it happened in the aftermath of decades of systematic co-opting and weaponization of the international rules-based order and its institutions and human rights. And so I would begin my analysis with a 1975 Zionism is Racism UN resolution. Soviet propaganda passed in the UN, alive and well on 2024 university campuses, Zionism is racism. I'll share anecdotally that when I come to any campus across the North America, the United States, and Canada, when I come to campus to speak about anti-Semitism, the greeting or the demonstrations against me are always anti-Zionism. From NYU Law School's sidewalk, on which in big pink chalk letters it said "Zionists not welcome," to every other campus in which I have spoken, in which the demonstrations against anti-Semitism being discussed in any context is actually anti-Zionism. The understanding that Zionism is racism became what is the first blood libel, if you will, that enabled and fueled this continued co-opting and weaponization of that international rules-based order and the institutions entrusted to uphold, promote, and protect. And if there are any lawyers here or non-lawyers, we understand that selective application of any rule, of any principle, compromises the rule or the principle. Well, in fact, that's what we have seen systematically in the UN institutions, in the international mechanisms like the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, like the ICC, the International Criminal Court. That understanding that Zionism is racism, the first blood libel, enabled or paved the path, if you will, for the second blood libel. Following the 2001 Durban Conference Against Racism in none other than Durban, South Africa, that turned into an anti-Semitic hate fest that actually made clear to those that were present from the non-governmental organization world that it was, in fact, international law and human rights that were co-opted and weaponized to enable this mutation of anti-Semitism that would label the state of Israel not only Zionism as racism, but Israel as an apartheid state. That next blood libel that led to what we now know of as 23 years of Israel apartheid weeks on campuses across North America and other parts of the world. Israel apartheid weeks that became what 23 years of graduates have not only come to know Zionism as racism, blood libel number one, but Israel's an apartheid state. And I will say the second most important thing that happened, or I'll say the most important thing that happened as a result of that 2001 Durban Conference Against Racism turned anti-Semitic hate fest, is actually the process that was launched to creating a comprehensive definition of anti-Semitism that took into account precisely the co-opting and weaponization of the international rules-based order and human rights, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, the result of a long democratic process that's been adopted by more than 40 countries, by more than 1,200 entities, including, I understand, your university that has adopted the IHRA, and the understanding that the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance is a critical resource that enables to identify and combat what is an ever mutating hatred that has been alive for as long as the Jewish people have been alive, mutating each and every time or each and every era by latching onto the guiding social construct of the time, religion, science, and the secular religion of our times, human rights. That is what launched the IHRA's process in defining anti-Semitism. And I will say it is what makes the IHRA a critical resource that includes the 11 examples of the mutation of anti-Semitism, because as we know, in a post-COVID era, when there is a virus, it does not help if we inoculate our spaces and places against the older permeations of the virus. And we have to actually create a comprehensive inoculation, if you will, COVID-19 and Omicron. So the new strain of anti-Semitism that presented itself to anybody who's paying attention in the responses to 10/7, not only in the decades preceding, but in the responses to 10/7, is of course anti-Zionism, or the negation of Israel's very right to exist. And the IHRA is critical to being able to identify precisely that with what's known as Natan Sharansky's 3 Ds: the demonization, the delegitimization, and the double standards against the state of Israel, the Jew among the nations, if you will. Whereas traditional anti-Semitism bars the individual Jew from an equal place in society, the modern mainstream mutated strain of anti-Semitism bars the Jew among the nations from an equal place in the family of nations that it was to have. And if I take that fast forward to our time right now, and maybe you hear it in my voice, the existential nature of this moment and the urgency with which I feel, I do believe that we are actually living through the third and most Orwellian milestone, if you will, or inversion of fact and of law. And that is the co-opting and the weaponization of the Holocaust itself, of genocide, a term that, as my father taught me, we should shudder when we even speak. A term that, as we know, was coined by Raphael Lemkin in order to describe the atrocities of the Holocaust, too terrible to imagine, but not too terrible to have happened, that required such a term alongside crimes against humanity coined by Lauterbach, and the understanding that the Convention for the Prevention and the Punishment of the Crime of Genocide would actually be utilized in the most Orwellian fashion, as I said, inversion of fact and of law, by none other than South Africa, to allege that the state of Israel is perpetrating genocide in the International Court of Justice, even as the Jew among the nations, the state of Israel, defends itself in a post-10/7 reality from a genocidal terror organization, but one proxy, and that brings us to last night, of a murderous Islamic regime in Iran, alongside the Houthis from the Red Sea and Hezbollah from the north, that we know have been in a multi-front war, actually challenging Israel not only on 10/7, but since 10/7, with hundreds and hundreds barrages of rockets being fired by those proxies at Israelis. And I should mention, from an international law perspective, each one of those rockets a double war crime. A double war crime because it not only targets civilians, but it does so from densely populated areas of civilians in Gaza, in Lebanon. And the understanding that those thousands of double war crimes, not one has been condemned by those international institutions mandated, entrusted to uphold, promote, and protect those foundational principles equally and consistently, lest they undermine the entire system. And here we are, at this intersection, at this moment in time, where, as Alvin said, last night was actually the quiet part just said out loud. That murderous Islamic regime in Iran that does the very same things to its own people, the same modus operandi of 10/7, that rapes, that mutilates, that abducts, that executes the very same things that Iran attacks Israel last night. And we have to remember, if we go back to the Orwellian nature of the moment that we're in, that on March 18th, that Iran became president of the UN Disarmament Conference, that just weeks after 10/7, that Iran became the chair of the UN Human Rights Council Social Forum, an Orwellian inversion of fact and of law. And when we meet at this moment and really look through the prism of anti-Semitism, use anti-Semitism as a lens, I do believe that enables us to understand the existential challenge of this moment. An existential challenge, certainly to the state of Israel, the Jew among the nations, on the front lines, if you will, of this war of barbarism on our shared civilization. Certainly, an existential moment for Jews around the world that, as a response to those atrocities of 10/7, have been attacked across campuses, cities, social media spaces around the world. And certainly, this existential moment to the shared foundational principles of all democracies as we zoom out and understand that this is a moment in which those authoritarian regimes that always say what they mean and mean what they say, Iran, Putin's Russia, China, North Korea, this creation of an axis of evil that very clearly has one thing that binds it together in the attempt to actually not only identify the strengths of democracies in order to undermine them, intersecting with what you will maybe be exposed to as progressive voices, but there is nothing progressive about 10/7 in what happened then, which is a very important conversation. But actually intersecting in this one idea that enables to transcend politics, and that is anti-Semitism. The understanding that the same anti-Semitism as defined in the IRA is the anti-Semitism that we see systematically in what it is that Iran, including on social media platforms, because they have not adopted the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism. So the supreme leader of Iran regularly, including last night and including days before 10/7, tweets about, of course, none other than the Zionist cancer, which Zionist, just coding Jew, enables to use those mechanisms to peddle anti-Semitism. Of course, in the university spaces, as we have seen, and as I mentioned, the demonstrations that we saw in universities, those are not pro-Palestinian. Those are not pro-peace. What they are is pro-Hamas, a genocidal terror organization that perpetrated atrocities too terrible to believe, but not too terrible to have happened, that from the river to the sea, and glory to our martyrs, just days after 10/7, Hamas charter was projected on George Washington University's library. And the understanding that when we meet now, what we see is actually the imperative to zoom out. And I'll leave a little bit of optimism or hope, as the late Rabbi Sacks actually differentiated between optimism and hope, in that optimism is a very passive virtue and doesn't take very much courage, whereas hope is a very active virtue that takes a great deal of courage. And I remind us that Israel's national anthem is Hatikvah, the hope. The understanding that the hope that we feel now was actually a part of what we also saw last night. And I want to be very clear. What we saw last night with actions speaking louder than words is another manifestation of what I would call the prospective paradigmal shift of the Abraham Accords. And what do I mean by that? What we saw is a coalition, a quiet one, and many of the countries that were involved probably we shouldn't even be speaking about. But the understanding that alongside the Zionism is Racism 1975 resolution, just shortly afterward, the three no's of Khartoum, no to recognition of Israel, no to negotiation with Israel, and no to peace with Israel. When the Abraham Accords in the Knesset that I was actually, I'd say, honored to sit in and be able to sign on the Abraham Accords, what they embodied was that inherent paradigmal shift from the three no's of Khartoum to the three yeses. To recognition of Israel, to negotiation with Israel, and to peace with Israel. The amazing moment and prospect that we have there for all peoples of the region and beyond, including Palestinians, requires one thing and one thing only: the recognition of the State of Israel, exactly as it was founded to be, according to its Declaration of Independence, the nation state of an indigenous people returned after millennia of exile and persecution, committed to equality that enables negotiation. And that paves the path to peace. What we know more than ever at this moment from the lens of anti-Semitism is that if we are serious about any prospects of any moving forward to peaceful resolution with any entity, then we cannot talk about a rejuvenated Palestinian Authority that peddles the same anti-Semitism as Hamas, that pays to slay Jews, as including those that perpetrated the atrocities of 10/7. The understanding that anti-Semitism enables us to use it as a lens that transcends politics. And there is nothing moderate about anti-Semitism that requires us to hold our own governments around the world to account for funding UNRWA, born in sin, in double standards, actually creating one single group of refugees out of Palestinians, whereas the rest of the world's refugees receive a single agency, the UNHCR, where UNRWA actually continues and perpetuates the refugee status of Palestinians as opposed to any other refugees in the world, passing down refugee status from generation to generation. And finally, where UNRWA not only inculcated the 3,000 plus barbaric savages that perpetrated the atrocities of 10/7 with anti-Semitic hate, actually funded by countries, Germany, Canada, the United States, France, that would never allow to teach such anti-Semitic curriculum, but that it continues to indoctrinate children now with that same anti-Semitic hate. It enables us to transcend real and perceived differences of politics and geography and religion to understand that anti-Semitism is but a predictor for what ails our societies and spaces, what challenges our societies and spaces, and what enables the enemies of democracy seeking to undermine democracy, or that have identified liberal values as weaknesses rather than strengths, in order to be able to combat precisely what it is that those that have created this axis of evil have identified with anti-Semitism as what unites them. So I'm very grateful. I think I'm going to end here and enable us a conversation so that we can drill down on what it is that interests those that are here and have joined us. And I just want to say three sort of wrap-up points. Anti-Zionism is the new mutated mainstream strain of anti-Semitism. It has to be identified if we're going to be able to combat entirely or comprehensively anti-Semitism as it has appeared in a post-10/7 reality. Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and prototypical indigenous people returned after millennia of exile and persecution. It is not that Israel exists because the Holocaust occurred, not at all. In fact, and as my father taught me, it's exactly the opposite. Had the state of Israel existed, the Holocaust could not have occurred. Therefore, it is not a 75-year-old European colonialist project, not at all. Hence, the importance of the Declaration of Independence. And finally, the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism, the single comprehensive definition that enables to identify and combat all strains of anti-Semitism as a working definition, primarily, and I'll say in all spaces and places, but primarily in national strategies for combating anti-Semitism, in city spaces and in educational spaces, in any university or high school or educational mechanism that actually is committed to identifying and combating anti-Semitism, to ensure that equal and consistent application is applied across the board. It cannot do that without the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism, including in the diversity, equity, and inclusion infrastructure, in which we know that other students are afforded protections, in the social media spaces, in which we know that there are actually protected characteristics, and certainly not in the international institutions, in which we know that there are rules of conduct or the international rules-based order. In all of those places and spaces, the assumption is that rules have to be applied equally and consistently. They have to include a comprehensive definition of what it is that we are attempting to identify and combat. And in this case, it is anti-Semitism and the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism that we have to be using. Thank you, everybody.